The kitchen clean, John asked Anne to go out for a sunset walk. She hesitated, unwilling. But it was one of her rituals, and everyone knew it, and with a quick grimace and a hard glance, she agreed. Once outside, he led her up to the same peak he had napped on. The sky was a plum-colored arch over the black serrated ridges surrounding them, and stars were popping into existence in a flood, hundreds per eye blink. He stood by her side. She stared away from him. The ragged skyline might have been a scene from Earth. She was a bit taller than him, a gaunt, angular silhouette. John liked her, but whatever reciprocal liking she may have had for him, and they had had some good talks in years past, had dissipated when he chose to work with Sax. He could have done anything he liked, her hard look said, and yet he had chosen terraforming. Well, it was true. He put his hand before her, forefinger raised. She punched her wrist pad, and suddenly her breathing sighed in his ear. What? She said, without looking his way. It's about the sabotage incidents, he said. I thought so. I suppose Russell thinks I'm behind them. It's not so much that. Does he think I'm stupid? Does he imagine I think a little bit of vandalism will stop you from your boys' games? Well, it's more than little bits. There have been 6 major incidents now, and any of them could have killed people. Knocking mirrors out of orbit can kill people? If they're doing maintenance on them. She humphed. What else has happened? A truck was knocked off one of the Mohol shaft roads yesterday and almost landed on me. He heard her breath catch. That's the 3rd truck to go. And that mirror was knocked into a spin with a maintenance worker on it, and she had to do a free solo to a station. It took her more than an hour to get there, and she almost didn't make it. And then an explosives dump went off by accident at the Elysian Mohol, a minute after a whole crew left it. And all the lichen at Underhill were killed by a virus that shut down the whole lab. Anne shrugged. What do you expect from gems? It could have been an accident. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more often. It wasn't an accident. It all adds up to peanuts. Does Russell think I'm stupid? You know he doesn't. But it's a matter of tipping the balance. A lot of Terran money is being invested in the project, but it wouldn't take much bad publicity to get a lot of it to drop out. Maybe so, Anne said. But you ought to listen to yourself when you say things like that. You and Arkady are the biggest advocates of some kind of new Martian society. You two plus Hiroko, maybe. But the way Russell and Frank and Phyllis are bringing up Terran capital, the whole thing's going to be out of your hands. It'll be business as usual, and all your ideas will disappear. I tend to think we all want something similar here, John said. We want to do good work in a good place. We just emphasize different parts of the process of getting there, that's all. If we only coordinated our efforts and worked as a team... We don't want the same things, Anne said. You want to change Mars, and I don't. It's as simple as that. Well, John faltered before her bitterness. They were moving slowly around the hill in a complicated dance that imitated the conversation, sometimes face to face, sometimes back to back, and always her voice was right in his ear and his in hers. He liked that about Walker conversations, and used it, that insidious voice in the ear which could be so persuasive, caressing, hypnotic. It's not that simple, even so. I mean, you ought to be helping those of us who are closest to your beliefs, and opposing those furthest away. I do that. Which is why I came to ask you what you know about these saboteurs. It makes sense, right? I know nothing about them. I wish them luck. In person? What? I've traced your movements in the last couple of years, and you've always been near every incident, within a month or so before it happened. You were in Senzeni Na a few weeks ago on your way here, right? He listened to her breathe. She was angry. Using me as cover, she muttered, and something more he didn't catch. Who? She turned her back on him. You should ask the coyote about this stuff, John.
The coyote?
She laughed shortly. Haven't you heard of him? He wanders around on the surface without a walker, people say. Pops up here and there, sometimes on both sides of the world in a single night. New big man himself, back in the good old days. And a big friend of Hiroko's, and a big enemy of terraforming. Have you met him? She didn't reply. Look, he said, after nearly a minute of their shared breathing. People are going to get killed. Innocent bystanders. Innocent bystanders are going to get killed when the permafrost melts and the ground collapses under our feet. I don't have anything to do with that, either. I just do my work, trying to catalog what was here before we came. Yes, but you're the most famous Red of all, Anne. These people must have contacted you because of that, and I wish you'd discourage them. It might save some lives. She turned to face him. Her helmet's faceplate reflected the western skyline, purple above, black below, the border between the two colors jagged and raw. If you left the planet alone, it would save lives. That's what I want. I'd kill you if I thought it would help. After that, there was little to say. On the way back down to the trailer, he tried another topic. What do you think happened to Hiroko and the rest of them?
They disappeared.
John rolled his eyes. She didn't talk to you about it?
No.
Did she talk to you?
No.
I don't think she talked to anyone but her group. Do you know where they went?
No.
Do you have any idea why they left?
They probably wanted to get free of us. Make something new. What you and Arkady say you want, they really wanted.
John shook his head. If they do it, they'll do it for 20 people. I mean to do it for everyone.
Maybe they're more realistic than you.
Maybe. We'll find out. There's more than one way to do this, Anne. You have to learn that. She didn't reply. The others stared at them as they entered the trailer, and Anne, storming into the kitchen nook, was no help. John sat on the arm of the one couch and asked them more questions about their work and about groundwater levels in Argyre and the southern hemisphere generally. The big basins were low in elevation, but had been dehydrated in the impacts that formed them, and in general it appeared that the planet's water had mostly seeped north. Another part of the mystery. No one had ever explained why the northern and southern hemispheres were so different. It was the problem in areology, a solution to which might prove the key to explaining all the other enigmas of the Martian landscape, as tectonic plate theory had once explained so many different problems in geology. In fact, some people wanted to use the tectonic explanation again, postulating that an old crust had slid over itself onto the southern half, leaving the north to form a new skin, then all of it freezing in position when planetary cooling stopped all tectonic movement. Anne thought that was ridiculous. In her opinion, the northern hemisphere was simply the biggest impact basin of all, the ultimate bang of the Noachian. A similar-sized strike had knocked the moon out of the earth, probably around the same time. The areologists discussed various aspects of the problem for a while, and John listened, asking an occasional neutral question. They turned on the TV for news from Earth and watched a short feature on the mining and oil drilling that was starting in Antarctica.
That's our doing, you know,
Anne said from the kitchen.
They kept mining and oil out of Antarctica for almost 100 years, ever since the IGY and the First Treaty.
But when terraforming began here, it all collapsed. They're running out of oil down there, and the Southern Club is poor. And there's a whole continent of oil and gas and minerals right next to them, being treated like a national park by the rich northern countries. And then the South saw these same rich northern countries start to take Mars completely apart,
and they said, "What the hell? You can tear a whole planet apart, and we're supposed to protect this iceberg we've got right next door with all these resources we desperately need? Forget it." So they broke the Antarctic Treaty, and there they are drilling, and no one's done a thing about it. And now the last clean place on Earth is gone, too.
She walked over and sat before the screen, stuck her face in a mug of steaming hot chocolate.
"There's more if you want," she said to John rudely.
Simon gave him a sympathetic glance, and the others stared round-eyed at the both of them, looking appalled to see a fight between two of the first hundred. What a joke that was. It almost made John laugh, and when he got up to pour a mug for himself, he leaned over impulsively and kissed Anne on the top of the head. She stiffened, and he went on to the kitchen.
"We all want different things from Mars," he said, forgetting he had just said the opposite to Anne out on the hill. "But here we are, and there aren't that many of us, and it's our place. We make what we want of it, like Arkady says. Now you don't like what Sax or Phyllis want, and they don't like what you want, and Frank doesn't like what anyone wants. And more people are coming every year supporting one position or another, even if they don't know it. So it could get ugly. In fact, it's started to get ugly already with these attacks on equipment. Can you imagine that happening at Underhill?"
"Hiroko's group was ripping off Underhill the whole time they were there," Anne said. "They had to have been to take off like that."
"Yeah, maybe. But they weren't endangering people's lives."
The image of the truck falling down the shaft came to him again, quick and vivid. He drank hot cocoa and scalded his mouth. "Damn! Anyway, whenever I get discouraged about all this, I try to remember that it's natural. It's inevitable that people are going to fight, but now we're fighting about Martian things. I mean, people aren't fighting over whether they're American or Japanese or Russian or Arab or some religion or race or sex or whatnot. They're fighting because they want one Martian reality or other. That's all that matters now. So we're already halfway there." He frowned at Anne, who stared at the floor. "Do you see what I mean?" She glanced at him. "It's the second half that matters."
"All right, maybe so.
You take too much for granted, but that's the way people are. But you have to realize that you're having your effect on us, Anne. You've changed the way everyone thinks about what we're doing here. Hell, Sax and a lot of others used to talk about doing anything possible to terraform as quick as possible, driving a bunch of asteroids directly into the planet, using hydrogen bombs to try and start volcanoes, whatever it took. Now all those plans have been scrapped because of you and your supporters. The whole vision of how to terraform and how far to go with it has changed. And I think we can eventually reach a compromise value, where we get some protection from radiation and a biosphere and maybe air we can breathe, or at least not die in immediately, and still leave it pretty much like it was before we came." Anne rolled her eyes at this, but he forged on. "No one's talking about pumping it up into a jungle planet, you know, even if they could. It'll always be cold, and the Tharsis bulge will always stick right out into space, in effect, so there'll be a huge part of the planet that's never touched, and that'll be partly because of you. But who's to say that with that first step done, you won't want more?"
"Maybe some will. But I, for one, will try to stop them."
"I will. I may not be on your side, but I see your point. And when you fly over the highlands like I did today, you can't help but love it. People may try to change the planet, but all the while the planet will be changing them, too. A sense of place, an aesthetics of landscape, all those things change with time. You know, the people who first saw the Grand Canyon thought it was ugly as hell because it wasn't like the Alps. It took them a long time to see its beauty."
"They drowned most of it anyway," Anne said blackly.
"Yeah, yeah. But who knows what our kids will think is beautiful. It's sure to be based on what they know, and this place will be the only place they know. So we terraform the planet, but the planet aerioforms us."
"Aerioforming," Anne said, and a rare little smile flashed over her face.
Seeing it, John felt his face flush. He hadn't seen her smile like that in years, and he loved Anne. He loved to see her smile.
"I like that word," she said now. She pointed a finger at him. "But I'll hold you to it, John Boone. I'll remember what you've said tonight."
"Me too," he said. The rest of the evening was more relaxed, and the next day Simon saw him down to the airstrip, to the rover he was going to drive northward, and Simon, who usually would have seen him off with a smile and a handshake, at most, "nice to see you," suddenly said to him, "I really appreciate what you said last night. I think it really cheered her up, especially what you said about kids. She's pregnant, you see."
"What?"
John shook his head. "She didn't tell me."
"Are you the father?"
"Yeah," Simon grinned.
"How old is she now? 60?
"Yeah. It's stretching things a bit, so to speak, but it's been done before. They took an egg frozen about 15 years ago, fertilized it, and planted it in her. We'll see how it goes. They say Hiroko stays pregnant all the time these days, just keeps popping them like an incubator, same C-section, over and over."
"They say a lot of things about Hiroko, but it's all just stories."
"Well, we heard this from someone who supposedly knows."
"The coyote?" John said sharply.
Simon raised his eyebrows. "I'm surprised she told you about him."
John grunted, obscurely annoyed.
No doubt his fame meant he missed out on a lot of gossip.
"It's good that she did.
Well, anyway..." He extended his right hand and they shook, hooking their fingers in the stiff clasp that had developed in the old space days.
"Congratulations.
Take care of her."
Simon shrugged.
"You know Anne. She does what she wants."
So Boone drove north from Argyar for 3 days, enjoying the countryside and the solitude, and spending a few hours each afternoon ransacking the planetary records to track people's movement, looking for correlations with the sabotage incidents. Early on the fourth morning, he reached the Marineris Canyons, which were some 1,500 kilometers north of Argyar. He ran into a north-south transponder road and followed it up a short rise to the southern rim of Melis Chasma and got out of the rover to have a proper look. He had never been to this part of the Great Canyon system. Before the completion of the Marineris Transverse Highway, it had been extremely hard to get to. It was dramatic, no doubt about it. The Melis Cliff dropped a full 3,000 meters from rim to canyon floor, so that the rim had a kind of glider's view north. The other wall of the canyon was just visible out there, its rim peeking over the horizon, and between the two cliffs lay the spacious expanse of Melis Chasma, the heart of the whole Marineris complex. He could just make out the gaps in distant cliffs that marked the entrances to other canyons. Ayas Chasma to the west, Candor to the north, Coprates to the east. John walked the broken rim for more than an hour, pulling his helmet's binocular lenses down over his faceplate for long periods of time, taking in as much as he could of the greatest canyon on Mars, feeling the euphoria of red land. He threw rocks over the side and watched them disappear. He talked to himself and sang. He hopped on his toes in a clumsy dance. Then he got back in his rover, refreshed, and drove a short distance along the rim to the start of the cliff road. Here the transverse highway became a single concrete lane, and switched back down the spine of an enormous rock ramp that extended down from the south rim to the canyon floor. This odd feature, called the Geneva Spur, pointed north almost perpendicularly from the cliff, straight toward Candor Chasma. It was so perfectly placed for their purposes that with the road on it, it looked like a ramp that the road builders had constructed. It was a steep spur, however, and the road had been forced to switch back all the way down to keep the grade within reason. It was all visible from above, 1,000 switchbacks snaking down the spine, looking like yellow threads stitched down a bump in a stained orange carpet.
Boone drove down this marvel carefully, turning the rover's steering wheel left, then right, then left, then right, time after time until he actually had to stop to rest his arms and give himself a chance to look back and up at the southern wall behind him. It was steep indeed, fluted by a fractal pattern of deeply eroded ravines. Then it was off again for another half-hour's drive, hairpins left and right, again and again, until finally the road extended straight down the top of the flattening spur, which eventually spread out and merged into the canyon floor. And down there was a little cluster of vehicles. It turned out to be the Swiss team that had just finished building the road, and he ended up spending the night with them. They were a group of about 80, mostly young, mostly married, speaking German and Italian and French and, for his benefit, English in several different accents. They had kids with them, and cats, and a portable greenhouse thick with herbs and garden vegetables. Soon they would be off like gypsies in a caravan made up mostly of their earth-moving vehicles, traveling up to the west end of the canyon to thread a road through Noctis Labyrinthus and onto the east flank of Tharsis. After that, there would be other roads, perhaps one over the Tharsis Bulge between Arcia Mons and Pavonis Mons, perhaps one north to Echus Overlook. They weren't sure yet, and Boone got the impression they didn't really care. They planned to spend the rest of their lives traveling around building roads, so it didn't much matter to them where they went next. Road gypsies forever. They made sure all their kids shook John's hand, and after dinner he gave a short talk, rambling in his usual way about their new life on Mars. "When I see you people out here, it makes me really happy, because it's part of a new pattern of life. We've got the chance to create a new society out here. Everything's changing on the technical level, and the social level might as well follow. I'm not exactly sure what the new society should be or should look like. That's the hard part, after all. But I know that it should be done. And I think you and all the other small groups out on the surface are figuring it out on an empirical basis. And seeing you helps me to think about it." Which it did, though he was never much at doing it on his feet. So he just slithered along a bit more in his free, associational way, plucking whatever stuck out of the bag of his thoughts. And their eyes shone in the lamplight as they listened to him. Later he sat with a few of them in a circle around a single lit lamp, and they stayed up through the night talking. The young Swiss asked him questions about his first trip and about the first years in Underhill, both of which obviously had mythic dimensions for them, and he told them the real story, sort of, and made them laugh a lot, and asked them questions about Switzerland, how it worked, what they thought of it, why they were here rather than there. A blonde woman laughed when he asked that. "Do you know about the Bergen?" she said, and he shook his head. "He's part of our Christmas. Zami Klaus comes to all the houses one by one, you see, and he has an assistant, the Bergen, who wears a cloak and a hood and carries a big bag. Zami Klaus asks the parents how the children have been that year, and the parents show him the ledger, the record, you know. And if the children have been good, Zami Klaus gives them presents. But if the parents say the children have been bad, the Bergen sweeps them up in his bag and carries them away, and they're never seen again."
"What?" John cried.
"That is what they tell you. That is Switzerland. And that is why I am here on Mars."
"The Bergen carried you here?"
They laughed, the woman too.
"Yes, I was always bad."
She grew more serious. "But we will have no Bergen here." They asked him what he thought of the debate between the Reds and the Greens, and he shrugged and summarized what he could of Anne and Sax's positions.
"I don't think they are either right," one of them said. His name was Jürgen, and he was one of their leaders, an engineer who seemed some kind of cross between a burgomeister and a gypsy king, dark-haired and sharp-faced and serious. "Both sides say they are in favor of nature, of course. One has to say this. The Reds say that the Mars that is already here is nature. But it is not nature because it is dead. It is only rock. The Greens tell this and say they will bring nature to Mars with their terraforming. But that is not nature either. That is only culture. A garden, you know. An artwork. So neither way gets nature. There isn't such a thing as nature possible on Mars.
Interesting, John said. I'll have to tell Anne that and see what she says, but...
He thought about it.
Then what do you call this? What do you call what you're doing?
Jürgen shrugged, grinned.
We don't call it anything. It is just Mars.
Perhaps that was being Swiss, John thought. He had been meeting them more and more in his travels, and they all seemed like that. Do things, and don't worry too much about theory. Whatever seemed right.
Later still, after they had drunk another few bottles of wine, he asked them if they had ever heard of the coyote. They laughed, and one said, "He's the one who came here before you, right?"
They laughed again at his expression.
"A story only," one explained. "Like the canals, or Big Man, or Zami Klaus."
Driving north the next day across Melis Chasma, John wished, as he had before, that everyone on the planet was Swiss, or at least like the Swiss. Or more like the Swiss in certain ways, anyway. Their love of country seemed to be expressed by making a certain kind of life. Rational, just, prosperous, scientific. They would work for that life anywhere, because to them it was the life that mattered, not a flag or a creed or a set of words, nor even that small rocky patch of land they owned on Earth. The Swiss road-building crew back there was Martian already, having brought the life and left the baggage behind. He sighed and ate lunch as his rover rolled past transponders north. It wasn't that simple, of course. The road-building crew were traveling Swiss, gypsies of a sort, the kind of Swiss who spent most of their life out of Switzerland. There were a lot of those, but they were selected out by that choice. They were different. The Swiss who stayed at home were pretty intense about Swissness. Still armed to the teeth, still willing to be the bagman for whoever brought them cash, still not a member of the UN. Although that fact, given the power Unoma currently had over the local situation, made them even more interesting to John as a model. That ability to be part of the world, but to stand away from it at the same time. To use it, but hold it off. To be small, but in control. To be armed to the teeth, but never go to war. Wasn't that one way of defining what he wanted for Mars? It seemed to him there were some lessons there for any hypothetical Martian state. He spent a fair amount of his time alone thinking about that hypothetical state. It was a kind of obsession with him, and he found it very frustrating that he couldn't seem to come up with anything more than vague desires. And so now he thought hard about Switzerland and what it might tell him. He tried to be organized about it. "Pauline, please call up an encyclopedia article on the Swiss government." The rover passed transponder after transponder as he read the article that came up on the screen. He was disappointed to find that there was nothing obviously unique about the Swiss system of government. Executive authority was given to a council of seven elected by the assembly. No charismatic president, which some part of Boone didn't like very much. The assembly, aside from selecting the federal council, appeared to do little. It was caught between the power of the executive council and the power of the people, as exercised in direct initiatives and referendums, an idea they had gotten in the 19th century from California, of all places. And then there was the federal system. The cantons, in all their diversity, were supposed to have a great deal of independence, which also weakened the assembly. But cantonal power had been eroding for generations, the federal government resting away more and more. What did it add up to? "Pauline, please call up my constitution file."
He added a few notes to the file he had just recently begun. Federal Council, Direct Initiatives, Weak Assembly, Local Independence, particularly in cultural matters. Something to think over, anyway. More data to add to the stew of his ideas. It helped somehow to write it down. He drove on, remembering the road builders' calmness, their strange mixture of engineering and mysticism, the warmth of their welcome, which wasn't something Boone took for granted. It didn't always happen. In the Arab and Israeli settlements, for instance, he was received very stiffly, perhaps because he was seen as being anti-religion, perhaps because Frank had been spreading tales against him. He had been amazed to discover an Arabic caravan whose members believed he had forbidden the building of a mosque on Phobos, and they had only stared at him when he denied even hearing about such a plan. He was pretty sure that was Frank's doing. Word got back to him through Janet and others that Frank was prone to undercutting him in that way. So yes, there were definitely groups that greeted him coolly. The Arabs, the Israelis, the nuclear reactor teams, some of the transnational executives, groups with their own intense and parochial programs, people who objected to his larger perspective. Unfortunately, there were a lot of them. He came out of his reverie and looked around, and was surprised to discover that out in the middle of Melis, it looked exactly as if he were out on the northern plain somewhere. The Great Canyon was 200 kilometers wide at this point, and the curvature of the planet was so sharp that the North and South Canyon walls, all 3 vertical kilometers of them, were completely under the horizons. Not until the following morning did the northern horizon double, and then separate out into the canyon floor and the Great Northern Wall, which was cut in two by the gap of a short north-south canyon connecting Melis and Candor. It was only when he drove into that wide slot that he had the kind of view people thought of when they imagined being down in Marineris. Truly giant walls flanked him on both sides, dark brown slabs riven by a fractal infinity of gullies and ridges. At the foot of the walls lay the huge spills of ancient rockfall or the broken terracing of fossil beaches. In this gap, the Swiss road was a line of green transponders, snaking past mesas and arroyos so that it looked as if Monument Valley had been relocated at the bottom of a canyon twice as deep and 5 times as wide as the Grand Canyon. The sight was too astonishing for John to be able to concentrate on anything else, and for the first time in his journey he drove all day with Pauline off. North of the transverse gap, he drove into the huge sink of Candor Chasma, and now it was as if he were in a gigantic replica of the Painted Desert, with great deposition layers everywhere, bands of purple and yellow sediment, orange dunes, red erratics, pink sands, indigo gullies. Truly a fantastic, extravagant landscape, disorienting to the eye because all the wild colors made it hard to figure out what was what, and how big it was, and how far away. Giant plateaus that seemed about to block his way would turn out to be curving strata on a distant cliff. Small boulders next to the transponders would turn out to be enormous mesas half a day's drive away. And in the sunset light, all the colors blazed, the whole Martian spectrum revealed and blazing as if color was bursting out of the rock, everything from pale yellow to dark bruised purple. Candor Chasma. He was going to have to come back sometime and explore it. The day after that, he drove up the steady slope of the Ophir Road, which the Swiss crew had completed the previous year, up and up and up. And then, without ever seeing a distinct rim, he was out of the canyons, rolling past the domed holes of Ganges Katina, and then over the old familiar plain, following a wide road over the tight horizon past Chernobyl and Underhill. Then, on for another day west to Ekkes Overlook, Sachs's new terraforming headquarters. His journey had taken a week and crossed 2,500 kilometers. Sachs Russell was back from Acheron in his own place.
He was a power now, and no doubt about it, having been named by Unoma a decade before as scientific head of the terraforming effort. And of course, that decade of power had had its effect on him. He had solicited UN and transnational aid to build a whole town to serve as headquarters for the terraforming effort, and he had placed this town about 500 kilometers due west of Underhill, on the edge of the cliff that formed the eastern wall of Ekkas Chasma. Ekkas was one of the narrowest and deepest canyons on the planet, and its eastern wall was even taller than South Mellis. The section they had chosen to build the town into was a vertical basalt cliff 4,000 meters high. At the top of the cliff, there was very little sign of the new town. The land behind the rim was almost unmarked, only a concrete pillbox here and there, and to the north, the plume of a rickover. But when John climbed out of his rover into one of the rim pillboxes and got in one of the big elevators inside it, the extent of the town began to come clear. The elevators went down 50 floors. And when he descended 50 stories, he got out and found other elevators that would take him even lower, a whole series of them, descending right down to the floor of Ekkas Chasma. Say a story was 10 meters. That meant there was room in the cliff for 400 stories. Actually, not that much of the room had been used yet. And most of the rooms built so far were clustered up in the highest 20 floors. Sax's offices, for instance, were very near the top. His meeting room was a big open chamber with a continuous floor-to-ceiling window as its western wall. When John walked into the room looking for Sax, it was still mid-morning and the window was almost clear. Far, far below lay the chasm floor, still half in shadow, and there, out in the sunlight, stood the much lower western wall of Ekkas, and beyond that the great slope of the Tharsis Bulge, rising higher and higher to the south. Out in the middle distance was the low bump of Tharsis Tholus, and to the left of it, just poking over the horizon, lay the purple, flat-topped cone of Ascrius Mons, the northernmost of the great Prince volcanoes. But Sax was not in the meeting room, and he never looked out this window, as far as John could tell. He was next door in a lab, more lab rat than ever, hunch-shouldered and twitch-whiskered, gazing around at the floor, speaking in a voice that sounded like an AI. He led John through a whole sequence of labs, leaning forward to peer into screens or at inching graph paper, talking to John over a shoulder in a state of distraction. The rooms they passed through were jammed with computers, printers, screens, books, rolls and stacks of paper, disks, GC mass specs, incubators, fume hoods, long apparatus-filled lab tables, whole libraries. And placed on every precarious surface were potted plants, most of them unrecognizable bulges, armored succulents and the like, so that at a glance it looked like a virulent mold had sprung up and covered everything. "Your labs are getting kind of messy," John said. "The planet is the lab," Sax replied. John laughed, moved a bright yellow soroctic cactus from a countertop, and sat down. It was said Sax never left these rooms anymore. "What are you simming today?"
"Atmospheres."
"Of course." It was a problem that gave Sax a serious case of the blinks. All the heat they were releasing or applying to the planet was thickening the atmosphere, but all their CO2-fixing strategies were thinning it. And as the chemical composition of the air slowly shifted to something less poisonous, it became less greenhouse gassed as well, so that things cooled back down and the process slowed. Negative feedback countering positive feedback all over the place. Juggling all these factors into any meaningful extrapolative program was more than anyone had yet accomplished to Sax's satisfaction, so he had resorted to his usual solution. He was trying to do it himself. He paced the narrow aisles left between equipment, moving chairs out of his way. "There's just too much carbon dioxide. In the old days, the modelers swept that under the rug. I think I'm going to have robots feed the southern polar cap into Sabatier factories. What we can process won't sublime, and we can release the oxygen and make bricks of the carbon, I guess.
We'll have more carbon blocks than we'll know what to do with. Black pyramids to go along with the white.
Pretty.
Ah,